Remember yesterday when I said it really does look like the Kamala Harris campaign is slowly starting to circle the drain? And I gave you several examples of why this was so. From polling data, which is not good at all for Kamala Harris, to the outbursts and hair on fire remarks made by some liberal pro Kamala Harris commentators and the like. Well, now more stuff is coming in. And, you know, the latest example is that the Department of Justice, air quotes, because now it is thoroughly politicized and laced with left-wing ideology. The current Department of Justice is actually trying to force the state of Virginia to keep people on their voting rolls who admit in writing that they're not citizens. Let me say that one again, in case you think this can't be right. No, this is right. And it's being dramatically distorted by news media coverage. The state of Virginia is being told by the Department of Justice that they must leave people on their voting rolls who have admitted to not being citizens in writing. Glenn Youngkin is speaking out after Merrick Garland. By the way, a huge, huge thank you to Mitch McConnell, the 80-something senator from Kentucky, who, as Senate Majority Leader, refused to let the Senate even hold hearings on Merrick Garland for the U.S. Supreme Court when Obama named him to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the media said, oh, yes, he's a moderate, middle-aged, older, white male. Moderate. No, you see how he has conducted himself as Attorney General of the United States. He's not only ardently liberal, he is a vicious partisan. So the Attorney General Merrick Garland is suing Virginia for removing over 6,000 non-citizens from the voting rolls. Those people had checked a box that they were not legal citizens when they got their driver's license. And yet somehow they ended up on the voting rolls. So the governor of Virginia, his administration, Glenn Youngkin, Republican, enforced a law that has been on the books for 18 years. In fact, not 18 years. Yes, 18 years. And now he's being, this is a right-wing attempt to disenfranchise people of color. It has nothing to do with color. It has to do with the fact that you admit you're not a citizen. Here's what Glenn Youngkin, the governor, said yesterday on Fox News.
That bill was signed in 2006, and it requires us to use DMV data where people self-identify as non-citizens to then go through a process of removing them from the voter rolls if they're on the voter rolls. And guess what? That's exactly what we've been doing. It's been happening for 18 years. Democrat governors, even Terry McAuliffe and Ralph Northam, use this process all the way up through into October. And that's exactly what we're doing in Virginia today, is someone walks into the DMV, they identify themselves as a non-citizen, Somehow or another, either by accident or by purpose, they register to vote. They're on the voter roll. We go through a process of notifying the registrar that they need to be told that if they cannot affirm their citizenship in 14 days, they're taken off the voter roll. And this is the process that the Department of Justice, 25 days before a presidential election, turns around and says, you must stop doing this. And that is unbelievable to me.
It is absolutely outrageous that the Department of Justice is quite literally arguing that people who admit they're not citizens be left on voting rolls where it is illegal for someone who is a non-citizen to vote. The Department of Justice said, national voter registration mandate, officials across the country need to remove people 90 days or further, 90 days out. So says Kristen Clark, the Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division. By the way, this is the same Kristen Clark who is now telling police departments and fire departments that if they want to hire people for the force, that they can't hire you, and they can't use a test where larger proportions of females than males fail the fitness exam, or larger numbers of applicants of color fail the aptitude test. So, I mean, that is how they see civil rights. Not where you minimize color, but where you obsess on color. And if there's any kind of disproportion, then that is proof of sexism. That is proof of racism. Get rid of that exam. Change that exam. So this is what we are dealing with 3 weeks out from an election. And it's like I was telling you, it's just another sign the Democrats are now getting desperate. They're so desperate that they are requiring states to keep people on their voting rolls who admit that they're not citizens. Anyway, Governor Youngkin continued his comments.
I mean, here I am, a governor, mandated and, oh, by the way, proud to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and by law to make sure that we have clean voter rolls. And the Department of Justice shows up 25 days before a presidential election and says, stop doing that. To me, this is unprecedented. And I think it represents a Department of Justice that is trying to achieve something other than fair and free elections. And I have to say, my job as governor is to make sure that the election in Virginia will be fair, will be accurate, and will be safe. And that's exactly what I am doing, and I will continue to do it because the Department of Justice is wrong here.
Good for you. The state of Virginia has removed 6,303 people from the voting rolls who are not citizens. And again, it's not that they conducted exhaustive, expensive investigations into people's citizenship and said, you know, we have been conducting an inquiry as to whether you're really a citizen or not. No, they just checked the DMV data. And are there people on the DMV data who admit they're not citizens who somehow ended up on the voting rolls? And if they find them, they are given 14 days. They're notified, you're on the voting rolls, but you say you're not a citizen. You can't vote in the United States of America in a federal election. You shouldn't be able to vote in any election, frankly, if you're not a citizen. So you've got 2 weeks to fix this. You know, maybe it's a clerical error. Maybe you are a citizen. Okay, that's fine. You've got 14 days. Let us know. And if they can't explain, if they can't prove that they're a citizen and explain the discrepancy, then they're off the voting rolls. They're not charged with a crime, which, you know, if you knowingly register to vote when you're not eligible to vote, you have committed a crime, a federal offense. But they're not doing that. They're just simply saying you can't vote. So the headlines used by the news media don't address this issue at all. Instead, it's, you know, Virginia under fire for removing people, removing voters before election. I mean, again, another example of how the media are in full campaign mode at this point. When I say media, mainstream media, not even the ardently liberal media. And again, look at how reasonable this action by the state of Virginia is. You're not supposed to vote in the United States. You're not eligible to vote in the United States if you are A, not of voting age. It was 21. The Constitution was amended in the early 70s so that 18-year-olds could vote. But you have to be 18, and they do check your age. You have to be a resident of your state. You have to be, in some states, you cannot be a felon and vote. And other states, you can. They changed Washington's law so that criminals can now vote. The Democrats needed to get out their base. But the kicker, it's in the U.S. Constitution, is you must be a citizen of the United States to vote. They don't check that. They don't check that in Washington. They do in other states. And when they checked in Virginia, they had thousands of people who had admitted they're not citizens on one form and then ended up somehow being registered to vote. So kudos to Glenn Youngkin for pushing back and fighting back. This was the guy, by the way, that I wanted to be Trump's running mate, because I thought he put the state of Virginia into play. And, you know, Trump went with J.D. Vance, who has been incredibly good. I think that of the four candidates who are, you know, on the tickets running for president, Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, Kamala Harris, and Tim Walz, I think that J.D. Vance has overperformed more than the others. I think he has been stellar. And you're going to hear him once again show no fear at all and show a lot of confidence and a lot of energy. And he's got his facts together. He's got his act together. Being interviewed by a New York Times reporter. That's something you'll hear a little later on. We got a busy day-to-day local and national stuff on the commute with Carlson. We also have Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner with a social media sweep. Still to come on the John Carlson Show, easily the worst political ad, the most absurd, the silliest, dumb political ad, which once again shows how utterly out of touch the Democrats are with yet another constituency they're trying to improve with. What's the constituency? Half the population, men. They actually put out an ad that they think is going to appeal to men. And I thought, and I think a lot of other people who saw the ad, who's thought it was a parody. It was a comedy. Some updates on Boeing. They're losing billions, not just in commercial aircraft, but in their defense division as well, and how these layoffs are going to be conducted. There's a lot of people going to be losing their jobs here, and we'll tell you when that all goes down, how it's being conducted. It's a busy morning on the John Carlson Show. No, radio legend. I didn't ask for Glenn Yarborough. I asked for Glenn Youngkin, Governor of Virginia.
That's true. Most definitely pro Glenn Youngkin, not so much pro Glenn Yarborough.
But you know what? Give me ideas. Rain tomorrow, not today. You still got to do
it. It's all about the rain, I guess.
Rain must fall.
Hey, rain tomorrow. It's coming.
I do love Glenn Yarborough. I do.
Local guy was up here in Squim for a whole bunch of years.
He did. That is true. Lived in Squim. And another great folk singer, Burl Ives, lived up in Anacortes.
Similar vibes there.
Okay. Anyway, what's going on in the social media world we call Twittersville Xville?
I was going to be riled up, and then we had this fun moment with Glenn Yarborough. But I was going to say it's mornings like this that I wake up and I kind of understand why our friends like Kirby Wilbur and some of the listeners to Carlson and KVI have decided that they need to move out of state because the politics of Washington State are just so loopy, ludicrous, and frustrating. And we'll start with this one from the group Fuse Washington, which is a progressive-leaning political outfit. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Fuse Washington has posted about Brian Haywood and Let's Go Washington and some of these gasoline price breaks that Let's Go Washington has been doing in an effort to call attention
events.
To
They're doing another
the
one
initiatives.
Today in Vancouver.
Exactly. The one today in Vancouver and the one tomorrow in Everett.
Tomorrow up in Everett.
Right. So here's what Fuse Washington posts. They write, Defend Washington, which is one of these other aligned groups with Fuse Washington. Defend Washington on Brian Haywood's discount gas stunt says, it's a criminal violation in Washington to offer consideration or gratuities or other inducements to influence people to vote yes or no on an initiative. And these events, like the gas price discount, are in clear violation of that law, end quote.
How?
And what's so utterly maddening about this is that Fuse Washington and Defend Washington have no short-term memory to remember when Governor Inslee decided he was going to offer $200 cash back on this natural gas situation for people to avoid voting for 2066.
Right.
So
remember,
what a bunch of idiots.
Remember, the earlier version of that bill would only have paid the $200 if the initiative failed at the polls.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, you can't do that. You either have to offer it or not offer it. You can't make it conditional. So they said, okay, let's just do it and then say, oh, it's courtesy of the Climate Commitment Act. Now, there's an example of trying to buy someone's vote.
What a bunch of horrible hypocrites.
So here's what the Fuse people should do. If they were smart, they would tell all their liberal friends, Go get discount gas and have Brian Haywood pay for it.
Yeah.
That's what they should be doing. Yeah. All the Democrats should go get cheap gas. And, you know, they could use the money they save to make a contribution to a liberal cause. Instead, it's, oh, you're breaking the law. Yeah. No, they're not.
Just be consistent. If you're going to criticize Brian Haywood, you got to go criticize Jay Inslee and all the legislative Democrats. They're not going to do that.
Of course not.
Yeah.
It shows, again, just how desperate the other side is getting here, trying to get people to vote no.
Man, I hope people wake up.
2117, which ends the invisible gas tax, the carbon tax on gas.
Okay. I have one more of these inconsistencies, and this is information that's cropped up over the last week, but it occurred to me last night. You've got the U.S. Department of Justice that is weighing an antitrust case against Google and is interested in breaking up Google because it's too big, right? They've got too much market share as part of the problem.
Yeah.
There's no check and balance, though, for doing that on the size of the federal government, is there? You notice Donald Trump in September was saying at campaign rallies, hey, there's no need for us to have a federal Department of Education. We could close down that federal agency. And Democrats freaked out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we've got this, again, this hypocrisy that we see Google as too big or too dominant, and we have a check and a balance to possibly run antitrust laws cases about that, but there's no such check and balance other than voting, you know, different congressional members, different president, different senators, for checking the size and the scope of the federal government.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Something that I think that we all need to take into account.
Quick history lesson about the Department of Education.
Sure.
Okay. It was created in 1979 by Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. He got it authorized, and it was the number one priority of the National Education Association, the Teachers Union.
Dun, dun, dun.
The day after the Department of Education was announced that it became a cabinet-level agency, the NEA endorsed Jimmy Carter for re-election. Right. That didn't turn out so well. But the bottom line is that department does not exist for kids. That department exists for the union. Mm-hmm. And education has always been considered not just a state issue, it's a local issue. Now, here in Washington State, it is funded primarily at the state level. Our state constitution requires that, but it is first and foremost a local government issue. If there's a problem with your school, you don't call your congressman, you go to your school board meeting and say, we got a problem with this teacher, or we have an issue with this principal, or what have you. So the more we get away from Washington, D.C., and get back to local governance of our schools, and ideally giving parents choice so that they become the boss. They're consumers, education consumers for their kids. They choose the school their kids goes to, the better. All right, it's 6:30 on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. When we come back, explaining just how deep the hole Boeing is in. You're going to find this very interesting and provocative. Is this a listener request?
No, just a song that came to mind after playing Herman's Hermits earlier. Okay. Freddie and the Dreamers, sound-alikes.
It's 23 minutes to 7 o'clock in the morning on The Commute with Carlson.
But a lot of songs are requests, Sean, as you know.
You can we are the one news talk station in America that actually takes music requests because, you know, we come in or out of, go into a commercial break or come back with songs. And we say, well, why don't we play hits from the 60s during the 6 o'clock hour and the 70s during the 7 o'clock hour and the 80s and beyond from the 8 o'clock, during the 8 o'clock hour. And so we started asking listeners, if there's something you want to hear, let us know. And my God, how many thousands?
it's therapy. I mean, 20 seconds of a song. Played. 20 seconds of a song like that, it takes you back to the first cars, dates, yeah. Classrooms.
It's in other words, it's popular. It's working. If there's a request you want to hear, then just text us your request. 206-421-5757. That is 206-421-5757. And let us know what you want to hear. And if you want, why you like the song so much, and when we can, we will play it.
Okay, Animals coming up. Just got a request fresh off of a text here.
Okay. It was I had heard that Eric Burdon lives in Tacoma, or was, you know, maybe that was him calling and he wanted to hear some of the good old days. Anyway, Boeing is in a real tough spot right now. Last week, they announced that they would be laying off 10% of their company. It's not because of the strike exactly, but it kind of influences what Boeing is doing. Actually, the machinists, the men and women who assemble the airplanes, are probably going to be the last ones to be let go. Because the only way Boeing's going to get back on its feet is to start building more airplanes. The reduction in force is part of a reorganization that their new CEO, Kelly Ortberg, who, by the way, was in Florida, he's moved to Seattle and hopefully is going to raise the corporate profile of Boeing. here in Seattle. Make it a Seattle company again. Wouldn't that be nice? It's when they started losing their way, when they began thinking of themselves as something other than a Seattle-based company. Anyway, Boeing's got some very broad and very deep problems. And this is part of that recognition. The initial cuts will be made among white-collar staff. We're talking engineers, even vice presidents, company vice presidents. There's going to be two phases of layoffs. Managers are now being asked to make their decisions on who gets laid off and who we keep. The first announced layoffs will be in mid-November. Now, they won't, the jobs don't end in November. The jobs end in mid-January. And those who are being laid off will only have to work a couple of weeks, and then they'll be paid off until mid-January, so they'll have time to look for other work during the holidays. And yes, those laid off not only will get roughly 6 weeks to find employment elsewhere, they will also get a severance payment. If they don't reach their targets in phase one, then there's going to be another round of layoffs a month later. Same story. The workers will be notified about 2 months before the end of their job. They'll have to work a couple of weeks to basically finish anything that's in the hopper. And then they'll be given the rest of that time to either take early retirement or find a job elsewhere. Now, they're not giving inducements to people to leave. They're not going to have a nice, handsome buyout if you retire early. This is just a straight, what they call, RIF. Reduction in force. They are cutting their payroll. The only good news in any of this for employees is that as employees retire or as they leave Boeing to go work for another company, that will count toward the reduction target. So maybe 17,000 people will not be losing their jobs, maybe be a little less than that. So how do they decide who's going to lose their job? Well, they have performance indexes at Boeing. Everyone goes through, you know, a job evaluation. How are you doing? Those employees who are poor performers, they will be on the first list to lose their job. Employees listed as lower performers will be the next to go. Those whose job entail a high cost, including overhead costs, they would be next. Managers are being asked, according to the Seattle Times, to identify, in the words of Boeing memo, work we can deprioritize and stop doing, close quote. In other words, getting back to basics. No machinists are going to be touched by this round of layoffs. Even in South Carolina, they are excluding production workers from the layoff. And keep in mind, in South Carolina, it's a right-to-work state. You don't have to join the union in South Carolina. So it's not because of union politics. You know, unionized machinists, production workers will not be affected by the layoff. And in South Carolina, where they have a 787 production line assembly plant, same thing. No one's going to lose their job. Getting back to what I was saying a moment ago about the only way Boeing's going to get back on its feet financially is to start building more airplanes. So that is the reality of these layoffs and how they will work. Now, as for the company itself, not only are they losing money on the commercial airplane front, they're losing money in their defense unit as well. They're taking $2 billion. This is according to BreakingDefense.com. They're taking a $2 billion loss on fixed price contracts. That'll be announced later this month. They have announced that they will stop producing the 767 freighter production, including the T-7A trainer, where they have lost $900 million. Boeing's defense unit expects to report $5.5 billion in revenue, but they will be losing an additional $2-plus billion. An operating margin of negative 43%. Same problem in the commercial division. They're going to lose $3 billion. We're not talking annual. This is for the quarter. This is for the quarter. Preliminary figures, but if they change, they'll change just marginally. Ted Colbert, who led the defense unit only since 2022, has left the company. They have not named a successor to head their defense unit. So this is a company that is in, as Donald Trump would say, not so nice, not a good place, in just about every division of the company, defense and aircraft. It is 6:47 on the John Carlson Show. Still to come, the single most ridiculous and unintentionally humorous political ad of the 2024 election season. We will play it for you. It's a TV ad, but it works for radio as well. The Kamala Harris campaign continues to lose momentum. Think of it as a balloon that was flying high and now, you know, over the last couple of weeks, losing a little altitude and now a little more. Now they're really losing altitude.
Is it a Chinese spy balloon that is floating to Earth along the eastern coast of the United States?
Everybody notices.
Passed over North America.
The Chinese balloon of the Kamala Harris campaign is losing altitude. Anyway, we are that and a lot more as the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Back in Seattle, that one is for you. House of the Rising Sun, a 60-year-old song. It was a hit in 1964, of course. The original goes back many years before. Anyone remember who wrote it? I think it was Woody Guthrie. Song about a brothel. Anyway, Jacqueline, congratulations. We're happy to do that. If there's a song you want to hear, just text us. 206-421-5757. And
Johnny, it kills me to correct you.
Oh, here we go.
Here we go. Right off the freaking
and
bad.
I'm not that knowledgeable about music. The House of the Rising Sun is a song that dates back to...
Okay, David Muir, go ahead and fact check me.
it dates back to the 1600s.
Oh, my.
I'm not kidding. And it's been recorded by tons of people over the centuries. And
really?
I'm sorry to say, yeah, the song actually goes all the way back to the 1600s. And so even Woody Guthrie may have been trying to get a little easy work done by saying, hey, I can repurpose this thing. The song was first mentioned in New Orleans in 1821, so it's now been 200-plus years since the song was mentioned in a publication.
Whoa. Okay. Now, you know what? You are correct. I was mistaking House of the Rising Sun for This Land Is Your Land.
Oh, you're right. Oh, and those were a government make-work job. You remember that?
Yes.
Triple C. So.
So anyway, I'm wondering, can you stick with me for a few minutes? Because I want to ask you, you've heard about this outrage in Virginia, the Department of Justice. I want to ask you how Oregon is handling this and Washington is handling this, since you vote in Washington and you broadcast in Oregon. Can you hang with me for a few minutes?
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
My good buddy, Lars Larson, our Noon to Three host, and I'm pleased to say fact checker for the John Carlson Show, right around the corner of The Commute with Carlson. Back we are, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Oh, boy, do we have a lot of things we want to talk about this half hour on The Commute. J.D. Vance squares off with a New York Times reporter. And the topic is housing, affordable housing. And the reporter thinks that she's cornering J.D. Vance. So, you know, how can we build more housing if Donald Trump wants to deport millions of illegals, many of whom work in construction? And you'll see how he handles that question. But let me just say, it's another example of J.D. Vance just continues to outperform expectations. I just can't tell you how pleasantly surprised I am with just how well he has conducted himself. Isn't that right, Lars Larson?
It is, Johnny. And I'll tell you, I hated to correct you before on the song, but, you know.
I looked it up and you're correct. It goes back to the 16. Well, there's a similar song in the 1600s, but coal miners were singing the song, you know, in the 19th century. So,
well,
yeah.
When you say a similar song, you can imagine lawsuits. We've heard lawsuits over songs that are not as similar as these two. But about J.D. Vance, he's right. And he's identified something that I think you and I have both talked about for years. And it is, we have a stunning number of what are called prime age men in particular. There are women too, but not as many. Men who are of prime age, meaning you are able-bodied, sound of mind, you're between 18 and 55. So you're not a child and you're not, you know, on the edge of retirement. You're in prime working ages, and they have dropped out of the labor force altogether. 7 million people.
Yeah.
And you wonder, are they all independently wealthy? Did they all win the lottery? How are they getting by? And they're getting by because we as a society have made it very easy to bum your way through life on the backs of taxpayers. And that's the blunt truth, because you sign up for food stamps, welfare, sleep on somebody's couch, stay in mom's basement, never mature. And I think it's shameful if a young man of working age is not being productive. We expect everybody who is capable of being productive in this society to be productive. For those who can't, for those with mental difficulties, for those with physical difficulties, we are a very generous society. But can you imagine creating a whole class of young, able-bodied men who bum their way through life and then say, oh, now we have to import a bunch of people illegally to do the labor that they should be doing? That's wrong.
And you'll hear how J.D. Vance handles this New York Times reporter. I would just love to see Kamala Harris sit down for a one-on-one interview with a hostile reporter and see how well she does. The reporter is Lulu Garcia Navarro. But that's coming up here on the commute. I wanted to ask you about what's going down in Virginia. I love how the governor there is pushing back, and he's pushing back strong on Merrick Garland, the attorney general, because the Department of Justice is suing Virginia for removing 6,000 non-citizens from the state's voter rolls. How did they find out they were not citizens? Because they admitted in writing that they weren't citizens when they were getting a driver's license. Let's give you just a quick recap here from Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, who is not going to meekly comply. He's pushing back big time.
That bill was signed in 2006, and it requires us to use DMV data where people self-identify as non-citizens to then go through a process of removing them from the voter rolls if they're on the voter rolls. And guess what? That's exactly what we've been doing. It's been happening for 18 years. Democrat governors, even Terry McAuliffe and Ralph Northam, use this process all the way up through into October. And that's exactly what we're doing in Virginia today, is someone walks into the DMV, they identify themselves as a non-citizen. Somehow or another, either by accident or by purpose, they register to vote. They're on the voter roll. We go through a process of notifying the registrar that they need to be told that if they cannot affirm their citizenship in 14 days, they're taken off the voter roll. And this is the process that the Department of Justice, 25 days before a presidential election, turns around and says, you must stop doing this. And that is unbelievable to me.
Okay. So they're pushing back. Again, these people had signed, when they got their driver's license, not a citizen. They checked the box, not a citizen. Then they signed their application to get the driver's license. And using that, Virginia gets in touch with them and says, the state of Virginia says, you are on the voter rolls, but you have admitted you're not a citizen. Can you reconcile this for us, please? You got 14 days. And if you are not a citizen, we have to remove you from the voting rolls. They're not going to charge him with a crime. They're just saying you need to leave the voting rolls. And that's what the Department of Justice is trying to prevent them from doing, which I just find unbelievable.
Consider this, John. Tomorrow is the deadline, or sorry, today is the deadline to register to vote in Oregon. In Washington State, you can register up to 8 days before the election. Yeah. So here we have the Biden DOJ saying, do not remove illegal voters. And that's what they are, illegal voters from the rolls. And if you say, well, what if they haven't cast a vote yet? Well, then they're illegally registered to vote. And as you said, give them a chance to get off. If they didn't do it, or if it was done automatically on their behalf, let them get off. But to say you have to do it 90 days out from the election, but you can register to vote up to 8 days from the election, somehow adding voters right before the election is okay with Democrats. Taking illegal voters off the rolls is worthy of a DOJ lawsuit. And, you know, Phil and I have talked about what happened in Oregon is still being under investigation. Earlier this summer, a liberal think tank in Chicago, ironically enough, said, we're curious about how it is that Oregon is automatically registering all drivers, those who get licenses, to vote, except they're also giving illegals knowingly to or driver's licenses to illegal aliens. You say, well, if you're automatically signing up everybody who gets a driver's license and you're giving driver's licenses to illegal aliens, how do you keep the two of them separate so the illegal alien with a driver's license doesn't also end up registered to vote? So this liberal think tank from Chicago filed a public records request and forced the state of Oregon to look for the first time. They immediately found more than 900 illegal voters on the rolls. And they said, well, that's it. We found them. Then they looked some more and found 300 more. And then a newspaper said, by the way, you're signing up people from American Samoa. They're not citizens, and they're not. They have a special relationship with the United States, and they can become citizens, but they're not citizens. And they said, oh, that's on us. Oops, we put that in the training that you should sign up people from American Samoa as citizens. And so they went off. Now it's the total number is more than 1,500. It's so bad that even the hard left-wing governor, Tina Kotek, has canceled automatic registration. for right now. They've turned the system off. But I don't think they've found all the illegal voters on the rolls. Go back to Washington State. About 6 months ago, a woman in Clark County, the county I live in, near Vancouver, was caught illegally registered and illegally voting as a foreign national. And she was investigated. And do you know what she told the investigators? Yes, I know I'm a foreign national. Yes, I know it's illegal for me to register to vote and vote. Yes, I have registered to vote and I have voted, and I'll do it again. And do you know what Tony Golic, the Democrat prosecutor of Clark County, said? I'm not prosecuting the case. So you have a criminal who's committing a crime that is punishable by 5 years in federal prison.
Wait a minute. That sounds like she's defiant. It doesn't look like, you know, I got a driver's license, and before you know it, I got a ballot in the mail. What the heck?
She did this over a decade ago, and she's been voting ever since. And what's crazy is I've had people call me and say, I have a foreign national wife or a foreign national husband. I've gone into DMV, and we present her foreign passport, and we say she's getting a driver's license, but she's legally here. She's got a green card. And at the end of that, the DMV clerk says, well, would you like to be signed up to vote? And the husband or the wife will say, hold on, my spouse is a foreign national.
I just told you, they're a foreign national. They're not a citizen.
And what some of the clerks have said is, well, you live here, you work here, you should be able to, you pay taxes here, you should be able to vote. That is their personal opinion. And I believe their personal opinions, and you tell me, if I check the voter registration of most public employees, Johnny, how many are D's and how many are R's?
Well, no, there's a strong tilt toward the Dems.
Yes, there is.
But
if you have the attitude that this shouldn't be punished, is it within the capability of a DMV worker, not the Secretary of State, not the legislature, to say, yeah, I think you ought to be able to vote. Go ahead and sign up.
The answer is no person should be voting who is not a U.S. citizen.
Except Joe Biden disagrees, and so does Kamala Harris, and they're suing Virginia to keep those illegal voters, foreign nationals, on the roll.
Again, one more example of how desperate the other side is getting. They are now trying to legally compel the state of Virginia to keep people on the voting rolls who have admitted in writing that they are not U.S. citizens.
And consider how you'd feel as a citizen of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Those 6,000 voters cancel out the votes of 6,000 actual citizens. Shouldn't that be a national outrage?
Now, let's go over some of the text remarks we're getting from our listeners. Carol, KVI listener Carolyn Kirkland, says, enough about Virginia. Has Washington's Secretary of State been updating our voter rolls like Governor Youngkin? Tell us if Washington has been cleaning their voter rolls of illegal aliens and dead people right now.
I don't believe they have, and I hate to say it, but the former Secretary of State, who was a Republican, young lady, Kim Wyman, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And she once told me, she said, well, we know they're not signing up to vote. And I said, how do you know? She said, well, that's illegal. So she was modeling Margaret Brennan's remarks on Sunday. Well, that can't be. I mean, literally, this dimbulb, Margaret Brennan, said, well, they can't be registering to vote. Why, that's illegal. And I wish that Mike Johnson, he's too polite, had said to her, you know what? Nobody died of fentanyl last year, Margaret, because I know 100,000 people died, but they couldn't have died of fentanyl because taking fentanyl is illegal. And nobody's car was stolen last year because that's illegal. And nobody in Chicago got murdered every other weekend because that's illegal. I mean, she sounded like as dumb as a bag of hammers.
Yeah. Dave in Yakima, KVI listener Dave, listening to us online at KVI.com, says, interesting, you need 90 days to remove people from the voting registry, but you can register the day of the election in some states, or in Washington, 8 days before the election. Got it.
They've rigged the system.
Again,
Trump is right. We've got to win big enough. Win so big they can't rig.
And start changing the voting system to build in safeguards to restore integrity.
How about e-verify everybody on the voter rolls of America?
Now, by the way, I do believe that every quarter they are supposed to wash the voting rolls because, people die. people move. People just drop off from voting for a long enough period where you
good
just...
Good luck with that, Johnny. But, you know who runs the voting systems in America? It's ERIC, E-R-I-C, a liberal organization, a private organization, has the control of the voter rolls for Oregon and Washington and a number of other blue states. And you say, well, those records are state records. Yeah, they may be state records, but they are not under the control of the state. The states have to go hat in hand to this private liberal organization and say, may we take these people off? And the general answer they get is no.
Well, then if that's the case, we've got an even bigger scandal on our hand, don't we?
We do. You know. Absolutely, we do.
Great stuff. Thank you very much, Lars Larson. And by the way, Philip J. Vandervoort III, let's see if Steve Hobbs will join us. Let's see if our Secretary of State, a Democrat, former state senator, and also a veteran, let's see if he will join us to address this issue in Virginia and explain how Washington State, how often we clean and cleanse our voter rolls. Because it's supposed to be done on a regular basis. I remember Sam Reed once telling me that he had removed 250,000 people off the Washington State voter rolls. It is coming up on 19 minutes after 7 o'clock. Philip J. Vandervoort III around the corner with the social media sweep. And then the worst, the dumbest, most absurd political ad of 2024. You'll hear it in about 15 minutes on The John Carlson Show. Just don't be knocking the social media sweep with Philip J. Vandervoort III. Live from Twittersville or Xville, what is going on in the social media world?
Twittersville, you might have to trademark that. There's some potential there. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. I found this in relation to what you talked about yesterday between Bill Maher and this 26-year-old singing sensation who wanted to comment on the Israel-Gaza-Hamas war stuff, Chapel Rowan.
Chapel Rowan, yes.
And what I came across was something at cosmopolitan.com, the Cosmopolitan magazine's website. And it's about Gen Z voters. And so Cosmo surveyed quite a few. I don't know if they put the bulk numbers in here of the amount of people that they surveyed. But they basically found that 18% of young people that responded to their survey, Gen Z people ages 18 to 28, 18% have no plans to vote in November. And they gave a variety of different reasons. And so I thought it might be interesting to go behind the scenes a little bit into the mindset of Gen Z and find out why it is that they don't feel compelled to vote. So Cosmo writes, the group of 18 to 28-year-olds we spoke to for this story had hard no's that were set in stone. Many didn't like either candidate. Others felt like they didn't know enough to cast a vote. And a few expressed dismay over U.S. involvement in foreign crises. And it's going to come back to the Israel, Gaza, Hamas stuff.
I prefer those people not vote.
And some were fed up with the entire political system or worried their votes just didn't count for much. One actually wanted to avoid jury duty, they say. So here are a couple of examples. Emily, 25, New York. She said, I don't feel educated enough about the candidates and issues. Mixed opinions from my friends and family adds to the confusion, making it harder to make a clear decision. Bella, age 21, is an American citizen living abroad, says, it's my first year being able to vote in a presidential election, and I, in good conscience, cannot support either candidate. So there's someone who's upset with both choices. And an 18-year-old in Tennessee named Jai says, Kamala Harris was not elected by anyone other than the Democratic Party. The thing that bothers me the most is that she wasn't truly chosen by the people. Trump is out of the question, and I don't want him to be president, but I can't bring myself to vote for Kamala Harris. I don't agree with some of her values.
I'm liking this trend a lot.
Yeah, well, at least a little bit of candor here from this 18% that say they're not voting. Here's a 27-year-old in Michigan named Josh. I'm conflicted. I believe in voting for harm reduction. On the other hand, I don't want my vote to be used as evidence that Kamala Harris is a popular candidate. I worry a high youth voter turnout would be taken as a sign that her background on her policies were the key factor in the race, and then the Democratic Party will lean further to the right. And that's a theme that comes up in a couple of other comments that they don't, they basically, the young people think the Democratic Party is too conservative.
It's never been.
Isn't that an eye-opener?
It's never been more liberal than it is right now.
Yeah. I think that's probably
That's what I have to say to all you progressives out there, all you progressive leftists, don't sell out your principles. Don't vote for Kamala. Stand your ground on principle and refuse to vote for Kamala.
Now, here's one more. Hannah, 26, California. In my view, the choice is between two deeply conservative ideologues who, aside from superficial gestures and platitudes, agree on most topics, with maybe the exception on abortion. The idea that someone is owed my vote is preposterous and antithetical to the idea of democracy itself. And that's kind of coming back to the battle Kamala Harris is facing with black male voters, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to get into that next hour on the Socialists on Social Media based on something Kamala Harris posted. All right. I think I got time to get into this. Dr. Kim Schreyers, Washington U.S. representative from the 8th District.
Getting a surprisingly strong challenge from Carmen Goers.
Yeah. So Kim Schreyer posts about this Safeway, Albertsons, and Kroger, QFC, Fred Meyer merger.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been putting this in her on TV campaign ads that she's opposed to this grocery store merger. She says, "We are all struggling with rising costs of groceries. Why? Big corporations are price gouging us. I'm fighting the Kroger-Albertsons merger that would close stores in Washington and increase prices. We need leaders ready to hold big corporations accountable." And this is just beyond laughable that, A, she's casting aspersions about price gouging at grocery stores when we all know the inflation. I mean, any of us that have been paying attention know about some of the sources of inflation caused by outsized federal spending and sending out too much money into the economy to chase too few goods. But meanwhile, and Maria Cantwell's campaigning on this as well, that she's against this grocery store merger. So you've got Schreyer and Cantwell who are completely silent about the crime, the shoplifting, the drug-addicted homelessness, the repeat offender public safety problems that we have just in the Puget Sound area, let alone around the state.
But the policies of their party are responsible for these problems.
They force companies like Kroger and Albertsons to hire more security staff at their stores. They've got to pay for plexiglass doors and locks to lock stuff up because people are constantly shoplifting. Those costs get passed along to the customer, along with the inflation on food, and that financial impact is crushing ordinary people who just need to buy groceries. But they're silent on that stuff, and they're like, I can't go with this merger. And if they don't go with this merger, guess what's going to happen? Do you know where Albertson Safeway stock has gone since Kroger offered $34 or $35 a share? It's now Kroger.
Where is it now?
Safeway Albertson's stock is at $18 a share. When this deal was proposed 2 years ago, Kroger was going to offer $34 a share. So if this merger doesn't go through, these stores are going to close anyway. These people are going to lose jobs anyway.
Well, here's the other thing. If there is gouging, then you can shop at Costco. Then you could shop at Walmart.
Yeah.
You know, those options. The massive grocery stores. So if you're also seeing high prices in those stores, maybe it's not gouging. Maybe it's the inflation and the rising costs and the supply chain disruption. Maybe that has a little something to do with these high prices. You know, the familiar retreat of, oh, it's just gouging. Again, that insults the intelligence of, well, intelligent voters. It is 30 minutes after 7 when we come back. The single most ridiculous ad of the 2024 campaign. Coming right up. You're going to hear it. 24 minutes to 8 o'clock. Here's the good news for Kamala Harris supporters. There's a gender gap. Women are 14% more likely to vote for Kamala Harris than for Donald Trump. She's out in front with women by 14 percentage points. Now, here's the bad news for Kamala Harris fans. There's a gender gap. Men are 16 percentage points more likely to vote for Donald Trump than Kamala Harris. It's a historic gender gap. Even Hillary Clinton wasn't quite this unpopular with men. So Team Kamala decided, well, we need to reach men. And so Jacob Reed, who used to work as a producer for Jimmy Kimmel, the Jimmy Kimmel Show, put together an ad where men were making the case for Kamala Harris. One of them is a cowboy hat wearing farmer and a mechanic who snarls at the camera, "I'm not afraid to rebuild a carburetor. I eat carburetors for breakfast." There's a rancher sitting on his pickup truck, the bed of his pickup truck, saying that, "I'm man enough to cook my steak rare." Then you see a guy in the gym who says he's man enough to deadlift 500 pounds and braid the blank out of my daughter's hair. This is the most pathetic and what is being called the cringiest political ad of the season. And of course, I thought you would want to hear it. So here is this ad, and I will, I will along the way interrupt to let you know what's going on, okay? This is that ad.
I'm a man.
I'm a man.
I'm a man, and I'm man enough.
I'm man enough to enjoy a barrel-proof bourbon.
Neat.
Man enough to cook my steak rare.
Man enough to deadlift 500 and braid the out of my daughter's hair.
You think I'm afraid to rebuild a carburetor? I eat carburetors for breakfast.
Okay, would this be the time to point out that there really aren't a lot of cars around that still have carburetors? I mean, if you're not going to a classic car show, it's kind of hard to find a car on the road with a carburetor.
Where are they located in some of these new cars?
Yeah. Anyway, shall we continue?
Afraid of bears?
That's what bear hugs are for.
I'll tell you another thing I sure as shit am not afraid of. Women.
I'm not afraid of women.
I'm not afraid of women.
They want to control their bodies? I say go for it.
They want to use IVF to start a family? I'm not afraid of families.
They want to be childless cat ladies?
Have all the cats you want.
Woman wants to be president?
Well, I hope she has the guts to look me right in the eye and accept my full-throated endorsement.
I hope she has the guts to look me in the eye and accept my endorsement.
Oh, this is creative. Can't wait to hear how much they pay.
Because I'm man enough to support women.
Man enough to know what kind of donuts I like.
Man enough to admit I'm lost, even when I refuse to ask for directions.
Man enough to not ban young women from reading Little Women.
There is no place in America where a girl is not allowed to read the book Little Women. Again, it's just
one of those pants books that the sisters like.
I'm man enough to raw dog a flight. It sucked. Not worth it.
I'm man enough to be emotional in front of my wife.
In front of my kids.
In front of my horse.
I'm man enough to
I'm man enough to be emotional in front of my horse?
That's a powerful line, John. I don't know. It's got my attention now.
I'll tell you that I cry at Love Actually.
Goodwill Hunting.
West Side Story.
That. And Predator.
And I'm sick of so-called men domineering, belittling, and controlling women just so they can feel more powerful.
That's not how my mama raised me.
I love women.
I love women who support their families.
Women who decide not to have families.
Women who take charge.
And I'm man enough to help them win.
Okay. I hope they play this ad everywhere.
Did you see this on TV already?
I've seen it on TV, but in news coverage of the ad. I haven't seen it playing as an ad.
All right, so it's coming.
Jacob Reed, who made the ad, is affiliated with Creatives for Harris. A couple of things you need to know. Again, you see ranchers, you see farmers, you see mechanics. What you don't see is anyone who's real. These are all actors. In fact, most of them work in improv, and some are comedians. The guy who says that he eats carburetors for breakfast appeared in a low-budget movie called Spaghetti Man back in 2016 about a superhero who shoots spaghetti from his hands. For some reason,
I missed that
his
one.
career has not thrived. The guy who says, I cook my steak rare, he's with the Los Angeles Upright Citizens Brigade, and he teaches improv for $75, get you a two-hour lesson. Okay. In other words, these are bit part, you know, not C-list celebrities, not D-list celebrities. We're down into
starving
J and K, all right, LMN string celebrities. They are such, when I saw this, I thought it was a Saturday Night Live parody. But it goes to show you how far out of touch these people are. First of all, the guy who says, I eat carburetors. Okay, I don't know if you remember the Saturday Night Live character, What's That? It's Pat. But, by the way, played by a local girl, played by Julia Sweeney, who attended the University of Washington with me. But What's That as Pat was an overweight guy, or is it a girl? I mean, this is before the trans politicization of gender. It was before the whole binary narrative. It's just someone, and the people around Pat try and guess, they would ask leading questions to figure out if Pat is a man or a woman. So hence the character's name, What's That? It's Pat. The guy who eats carburetors for breakfast looks like What's That? It's Pat. I mean, talk about someone who's clearly wearing a costume. And the upshot of this is they're trying to appeal to men. This is an ad that is supposed to draw men into voting for Kamala Harris. This is the kind of thing that's supposed to appeal to you as a man. But liberals are not only so tone deaf about reality, but they are so ideological in their thinking that they think, oh, this is how you reach men. This is how you turn it around. This is how we regain our footing with men. Like I said, I hope they run this ad everywhere. Here's a reaction from Megan Hayes, who worked in the Biden White House. She was director of message planning for the Biden administration. She's less than impressed.
The message is condescending, right? Like, yeah, and I know it's my party. It just comes across as condescending. That in kind of like that ad seemed like a joke to me as well. But it's not the way that you would. I mean, if a man talked to me like that, women would be up in arms. They would
like sitting like this.
Yeah, like they would just be up in arms. It's just the message is just so condescending, yeah. And I think that the authenticity point is a really good one. That Democrats really want to go after men. They need to figure out a better way to talk to them, and they need to figure out a better way that's more genuine to who they are in their message.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
What demo do you think they're going for in men? 20s, 30s, 40s?
Well, 50s? these guys were of different ages, but most appeared to be in their 30s and 40s. And there were, you know, a senior citizen in there. But again, it's just so absurd and so infantile that you just look at it and smile and said, really, are they that desperate? Are they so out of touch, first of all, that they think this is how you reach men, that this is how you connect? Because it is, I mean, mockery and ridicule is the only appropriate response to an ad like.
I don't know. I get emotional with a horse. I eat carburetors for lunch.
I eat carburetors.
Got my attention. I'm waiting for the movie. Oh, it's not a movie.
It's 48 minutes after 7, however. It's the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. 3.5 minutes after 7 o'clock. 7 minutes to 8, in other words. So, I just played to you one of the worst ads of the political season, the Meet the Real Men ad that the Kamala Harris campaign is running to try and reach men. And it's just laughable. You want to hear a really good ad, however? And it's a local one. David Olson is running for state school superintendent. He is a former Navy diver, turned banker, turned school board member, turned school board president, who is now running for the top job against Chris Reykdal, who's essentially a career politician and run, you know, been there 8 years, thoroughly mediocre results, you know, plowed a lot more money into schools and delivered thoroughly mediocre results. Here is David Olson's ad.
My name is David Olson. I'm a three-term, highly experienced school board member. Under Chris Reykdal's leadership, Washington's education system is failing our kids. Academic standards are declining. Gifted students aren't challenged, special needs students lack support, and teachers are burning out. In my district, students outperform state averages in reading and math. We help each student reach their full potential.
It's time to save our struggling schools. Vote David Olson for Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Every word there is true. David Olson would be just a wonderful, wonderful addition. And he has my endorsement, and yes, there will be a Carlson sample ballot for you if you are wondering who to vote for. Always happy to help out with that. That's coming later on this week. We'll add to it again, as there are a lot of races here in the state of Washington to keep an eye on.
Everybody's supposed to have ballots by Friday, I'm told.
The ballots are in the mail. Well, they're supposed to be in the mail.
They're sent on the 18th.
Mm-hmm. But yes. I'm already hearing reports that some
I got mine
places
last week
got their ballots coming in early. How about that? It is 4 minutes to 8 o'clock, hour number 3 of the John Carlson Show, right in front of us. Quick excerpt of a rally that was held on October 7th. That was the one-year anniversary of the savage assault on Jewish, mostly Jewish, civilians by Hamas, the terror group that runs Gaza. I should say that ran Gaza. The veil is completely off. These activists are now saying what they really have believed all along. You know, never mind all of the, you know, freedom for Palestine, I'm pro-Palestine. Every once in a while, they kind of let the veil slip a little bit by saying from the river to the sea. Now they're just making it really clear where they really come down on this conflict. Have a listen.
I stand here to commemorate 1 year of a flood of freedom, dignity, liberation, and return for the Palestinian people and all colonized peoples.
Can you believe what you just heard? Celebrate the 1 year anniversary of freedom and dignity by burning infants alive, by raping mothers in front of their families, their children, by burning families alive. What happened on October 7th was savage and depraved, resulted in, again, 1,200 people dying and so many others, 250 or so, taken hostage. And you now have someone saying that October 7th was a good thing. Was a good thing to celebrate and cheer, as you hear. But there were other speakers as well.
Glory to our martyrs, and death to America, death to this imperialist system, and freedom for all our prisoners, and freedom for all of Palestine.
Death to America. While you're expressing yourselves freely in America. Yeah, I wonder what would happen if she had walked into the town square in Gaza City and said, death to Hamas. I wonder how that would have gone down. Or freedom for the Israeli people, freedom for the Jewish people.
But together, in our millions, we must be loud and clear. Long live the resistance! Long live October 7th!
Long live October 7th. See, on July 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was signed, and the public was notified that there's a new birth of freedom. So that's the day we celebrate. The day these protesters celebrate is October 7th, a day when completely helpless Jewish civilians were slaughtered and often tortured before being slaughtered by Hamas terrorists. It's very, if you hadn't heard, some secret documents have surfaced that show that Hamas was trying to get Iran to join their October 7th attack. It also shows that their aim for 2 years beforehand, before October 7th, was to lull the Israeli government into a false sense of security that tension and violence against Jews and Israel was ramping down. It was dwindling. It was all a fraud. It was all a predicate for the attack on Israel. The documents the New York Times has written about have been authenticated. They represent, these are documents of Hamas commanders communicating with each other and with Iran and with Hezbollah. Quote, the documents, which represent a breakthrough in understanding Hamas, also show extensive efforts to deceive Israel about its intentions as the group laid the groundwork for a bold assault and regional conflagration that the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, hoped would cause Israel to collapse. Among the various strategies that they had intended were Hamas planned to carry out the attack in the fall of 2022, but they delayed because they were trying to get Hezbollah and Iran to simultaneously join the attack. In June of 2023, Hamas dispatched a top official to Lebanon, where he met with a senior Iranian commander and requested help with striking sensitive sites at the start of the upcoming October 7th assault. The senior Iranian commander told Hamas that Iran and Hezbollah, no difference there, Iran runs Hezbollah, were supportive in principle but needed more time to prepare. Hamas felt assured of its allies' general support but concluded it might need to go ahead without their full involvement to stop Israel from deploying a new air defense system. Hamas also was influenced by the increasingly warm relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. They didn't want normalized relations between the two. Hamas deliberately avoided any major confrontations with Israel for 2 years, from 2021 until October 7th, 2023. Quote, "We must keep the enemy convinced that Hamas in Gaza wants calm," close quote. And they got what they were looking for. Israel was lulled into a false sense of security. And then it struck back big time. But just so you know, that this was not an outbreak, you know, caused by anger and resentment, and finally the anger just boiled over, spilled over, and there was a terrible incident. No, no, no. This was all carefully calculated. I've told you before, if there's anything close to Satan walking the earth, it is Yahya Sinwar, the Bin Laden, if you will, of the Middle East and the head of Hamas. It is not currently known if he is breathing, if he's still alive or not. I hope he is not. And if he is, I hope he won't be for very long. Okay, you got 13 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, shifting gears. I had told you that J.D. Vance did an exceptional job in the debate with Tim Walz, has been doing an exceptional job in speaking appearances. He absolutely slammed the door on Martha Raddatz from ABC News and made her look foolish. And most recently, he sits down with an interview, a sit-down interview with, you know, a microphone overhead with New York Times reporter Lulu Garcia Navarro. She's trying to make the case that how can America build more homes if you want to deport millions of illegal immigrants, many of whom work in the construction industry? Here's how he handled that.
The reason that there is a housing crisis is that not enough houses have been built.
And that we have 25 million people who shouldn't be here.
Well, I mean, this is the thing.
I think it's both.
I know you do. I don't think that many people who look into this agree with you. But about a third of the construction workforce in this country is Hispanic. Of those, a large portion are undocumented. So how do you propose to build all the housing necessary that we need in this country by removing all the people who are working in construction?
I think it's a fair question, because we know that back in the 1960s when we had very low levels of illegal immigration, Americans didn't buy houses, didn't build houses. But of course they did. And I'm being sarcastic, of course, in service of a point, Lulu, the assumption that because a large number of home builders now are using undocumented labor, that that's the only way to build homes. I think, again,
the country is much bigger.
Fundamental.
The need is much bigger. I mean, I'm not arguing in favor of illegal immigration. I'm asking how you would deal with the knock-on effect of your proposal to remove millions of people who work in a critical part of the economy.
Well, I think that what you would do is you would take, let's say, for example, the 7 million prime age men who have dropped out of the labor force, and you have a smaller number of women, but still millions of women prime age who have dropped out of the labor force. You absolutely could reengage folks into the American labor market. This is, I think,
to work in construction.
Of course, you could.
I mean, the unemployment rate is 4.1%. Most people who
unemployment rate, Lulu, this is important.
But most people who don't work can't work in the regular economy. They're in the military. They're parents. They're sick. They're old. They might not want to work in construction.
The unemployment rate does not count labor force participation dropouts. And again, this is one of the really deranged things that I think illegal immigration does to our society.
By the way, are you beginning to see how she's scrambling? Beginning to see how she's kind of losing her sense of confidence and composure.
And how many times did J.D. Vance have to remind her this people being out of the workforce is 7 million men? And then she's talking about people in the military, people that are senior citizens. That's not what we're talking about, gal.
If you're in the military, you're not counted unemployed.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's continue.
Is it gets us in a mindset of saying we can only build houses with illegal immigrants when we have 7 million, just men, not even women, just men who have completely dropped out of the labor force. People say, well, Americans won't do those jobs. Americans won't do those jobs for below the table wages. They won't do those jobs for non-living wages. But people will do those jobs. They will just do those jobs at certain wages. And think about this from the perspective of an American company, okay? I want them to go searching in their own country for their own citizens. Sometimes people who may be struggling with addiction or trauma, get them reengaged in American society. We cannot have an entire American business community that is giving up on American workers and then importing millions of illegal laborers. That is what we have thanks to Kamala Harris's border policies. I think it's one of the biggest drivers of inequality. It's one of the biggest reasons why we have millions of people who have dropped out of the labor force. Why try to reengage an American citizen in a good job if you can just import somebody from Central America who's going to work under the table for poverty wages? It is a disgrace, and it has led to the evisceration of the American middle class.
Boom. Game, set, and match. J.D. Vance. I tell you, this guy is sharp. This guy's good. And he's utterly fearless and, as you hear, unflappable. Doesn't matter whether he's talking with a dim-witted governor from Minnesota in a debate or if he's talking to Martha Raddatz on camera, or whether he's talking to a New York Times reporter who thought that she had him cornered and ends up scrambling to keep up. Good for you, J.D. Vance. You've got 19 minutes now after 8 o'clock in the morning on the John Carlson Show. Still to come, a 4-youth crime wave has been dashed. They got the bad guys. Wait a minute, they're juveniles. They got the 4 children. We will be telling you a little about these children's backgrounds and what they were doing with their time. They weren't in study hall. When we continue, but first, Philip J. Vandervoort, the third favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists, coming your way on a very busy Tuesday morning. All right, Philip J. Vandervoort, the third, your favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists. What do you got?
Let's begin where we started back in the 6 o'clock hour. I was just so upset about this post on social media by the group Fuse Washington, which is a progressive left group here in Seattle. And it has to do with the initiatives, particularly I-2117, which would deal with the cap and invest law that results in this hidden gas tax that we're all paying. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. So Fuse Washington posted their criticism about Brian Haywood from Let's Go Washington holding these discounted gas sales for brief amounts of time at different gas stations around Puget Sound or around the state, because they've done them in Eastern Washington. They're doing one today in Vancouver. They've got another one planned tomorrow up in South Everett.
Tomorrow up in Everett.
Yeah, 128th Street Shell Station there off South Everett. So they post that, quote, it is a criminal violation in Washington to offer consideration or gratuities or other inducements to influence people to vote yes or no on an initiative, and these events are in clear violation of that law. And, of course, they completely ignore the fact that Governor Inslee has been touting $200 rebate checks based on the restrictions related to natural gas that the state has already imposed. And, of course, there's an Initiative 2066 that deals with restoring access to natural gas and new business and home construction. So they completely ignore that fact, but they want to try and call out Brian Haywood for these gas discount events. And it's incredibly hypocritical. I'll take it a couple of steps farther. Let's go with this. Brian Haywood has noticed that the Lake Washington School District in Redmond has been sending out a text message to parents of students in the district that says, tomorrow, Wednesday, the 16th of October, volunteers can text bank to Washington residents through the Save Children Action Network chapter. And this is all an effort to get out the vote around Initiative 2109. Is 2109 the capital gains tax?
Yep.
Because the school district is saying text banking is the process of reaching out and advocating to potential voters and supporters. We will specifically be text banking in opposition against Initiative 2109, as this initiative will cut billions in educational funding and child care. So the school district is now playing campaign politics.
No, that is illegal. That's brazenly illegal.
Okay. But Brian Haywood is posting that the school district is sending out these text messages.
Which school district again?
Lake Washington School District in Redmond. So there's that. And how about this from Kamala Harris's campaign? Under the social media handle at Kamala Harris, Kamala Harris posts this: Black men deserve a president who cares about making their lives better. And she includes a screen grab that says Kamala Harris will create an opportunity agenda for black men. First item, provide 1 million loans that are fully forgivable.
Oh, trying to buy them off.
$20,000.
Oh, man.
For black entrepreneurs and others to start a business.
You can't. You can't have a government program that is limited by race.
Well, yeah, just this whole idea.
Wow.
Vote for me. I'll give you that $20,000 startup loan. And, you know, this comes back to the whole student loan forgiveness debt thing. if the Democrats are as upset about this as they sound like they are, then they should stop doing exactly what they're complaining about Brian Haywood doing.
Well,
Brian
Haywood's program is, as I said, anybody can line up for gas, whether you're voting for the initiatives, against the initiatives, or you're not voting.
Yeah.
You can get free gas on this day at that particular gas station.
Discounted gas. But
discounted gas.
Yeah.
It's down to $2.99 a gallon. They're doing it tomorrow in Everett at, I think it's the Jackson's
Shell Station, off 128th in South Everett.
Yeah.
One more quick item. The Apprentice movie came out over the weekend. This is supposed to be the up-and-coming story of Donald Trump in New York City.
Right.
It made $1.5 million in 1,700 movie theaters. Now, that's a kind of a limited release. If you're a major film, you get released in about 3,500 theaters. So any major movie would have got released in twice as many studios. So even if The Apprentice, the backstory of Donald Trump, it got, you know, if it had been in wide release, it would have made $3 million. So where are all these Kamala Harris fans, these anti-Trump people? Why aren't they spending $16 a pop to go and watch this Donald Trump biopic movie? I guess maybe the
Because they're all watching the Reagan movie.
Oh, I was going to say, I was thinking maybe these reports inflation going down are over-exaggerated and not accurate because so many people are deciding they're not spending their money at the movie theater to see this Trump film.
Why would you bother? If you're going to go to a movie, why would you go to a movie like that?
Yeah. What were the movie makers thinking? Who wants to go see a Donald Trump movie?
Cast members of Reagan, by the way, attended a Trump rally this past weekend.
Yeah, Dennis Quaid.
Yes.
Great point. Dennis Quaid, who played Reagan in the Reagan movie, spoke out in favor at a Trump rally. It was very surprising, very, very good to see that because he has been pointedly avoiding politics in past years. All right, you've got 31 minutes after 8 o'clock on the John Carlson Show. Yesterday was Columbus Day, or as Kamala Harris calls it, Indigenous Peoples Day. And wait until you find out why she thinks it's so important to call it Indigenous Peoples Day. The John Carlson Show. Why does Kamala Harris seem so uncomfortable engaging with the media, engaging with the general public, using shop-worn cliches, slogans, catchphrases, always trying to catch a train of thought in the back of her mind when she's asked simple questions? Well, it's because she doesn't want to show who she really is. If you want to know what Kamala Harris really is, just listen to remarks she's made in the past when she wasn't vice president of the United States or she wasn't running for president. Here she is, for instance, on Columbus Day. I think this was about 5 years ago or so when she was a U.S. senator, safely elected. Here is what she had to say about Columbus Day and Christopher Columbus.
Since 1934, every October, the United States has recognized the voyage of the European explorers who first landed on the shores of the Americas. But that is not the whole story. That has never been the whole story. Those explorers ushered in a wave of devastation for tribal nations, perpetrating violence.
Because there was no violence between natives back then.
Stealing land. And
because they never stole land from each other, invaded other tribes' ancestral homelands. That was simply not done.
And spreading disease. We must not shy away from this shameful past. And we must shed light on it and do everything we can to address the impact of the past on Native communities today.
That's the real Kamala Harris. That's the real Kamala Harris. A leftist, an extremist, and someone who deeply, deeply resents this country. It's very ironic, you know, the things that she was saying we brought to North America, all of these things, including devastation by disease being brought up by natives from Central America or from Mexico, all of these things, in fact, often from just a few hundred miles away from in North America, all of these things were happening. And again, that doesn't justify or excuse any misbehavior, any oppressive actions by European settlers. But it does suggest there's some context here. And That is always the problem with the left and every issue related to America's early years is context. They talk about slavery like it was invented here. Slavery existed at the time of the American founding on every inhabited continent on the earth. It was ubiquitous throughout South America. It was ubiquitous within the United States, what became the United States of America. Indian tribes enslaving each other. And if you weren't enslaved, you might be sacrificed. Before Columbus arrived here, the Aztecs slaughtered 84,000 people in ritualistic sacrifices to christen, celebrate their newly built temple. They sacrificed these people usually by ripping out their hearts. So again, the driving need for people on the political left to resent this country, to hate this country, to find a reason to condemn this country. Again, we're not talking about being honest about our past. We're talking about people who are aggressively dishonest in cherry-picking incidents or facts in order to condemn this country. And Kamala Harris is part of that. And that matters. You should know that. What you just heard, that's the real Kamala Harris. That is the woman who would be president. All right. Back we are, the Commute with Carlson. It is 17 minutes to 9 o'clock. Yesterday's show was so packed, I wasn't able to focus on a couple of stories that need to be covered in far more detail than we have so far. An 18-year-old man and three juveniles have been arrested in a violent crime wave. For a violent crime wave, nearly 80 armed robberies and carjackings and burglaries that we know of, they suspect there are many more, carried out by four punks. Here's Como 4's Denise Whitaker.
At least 22 of the 78 violent crimes that these four are connected with happened in the city of Seattle. But the others have happened in other jurisdictions, a total of 9 different cities and jurisdictions all throughout King County. These are armed robberies, mostly 7-Elevens, some carjackings involved in this as well. And in most of the cases, the detectives tell me that the suspects would show up at a convenience store in a stolen car, back up to the door, was their MO. One person would pop the door open, someone would go in, they'd brandish a handgun and wave that gun around trying to get the clerk to give them money. In Seattle, Denise Whitaker, Como News.
Interim SPD Chief, Seattle Police Chief Sue Rahr, spoke about the problem of armed juvenile criminals here in Washington State, particularly King County.
For too long, we have been living in the world of either you treat them like children or you treat them like violent criminals. They are both. And the criminal justice system appropriately recognizes that there are differences, cognitive differences in juveniles. That doesn't diminish how dangerous their guns are.
Well, it doesn't diminish how dangerous they are. Because I don't care whether you are cognitively operating at the same level that you will be 10 years from now? Here, for me, is the question. Number one, do you know right from wrong? Number two, did you choose to do wrong? Number three, have you been given a break and you kept choosing to do wrong over and over again anyway? Those are the three questions that we should be asking. Because if they have been given a break and they continue to break the law, particularly if they're doing it violently, then yes, lock them up. They say, oh, they need to be in school. No, no. The last thing you should do is inflict them on a public, inflict the students of a public school with someone like that in the classroom. No, they should get their education while they are incarcerated, and they do that. But the reason why you had all of this violence, all this terror, all of this trauma was because when they had broken the law previously, they were able to get away with it. Now, the good news is that some of us demanded reforms in the juvenile justice system, calling for more accountability. Obviously, this was a long time ago. It was more than 25 years ago. We threatened to run an initiative if they pulled up short. So the legislature passed a law, a bill that was signed into law. And this bill mandates that if you are between 16 and 18 and you commit an armed crime, like sticking a gun in someone's face and holding up a store, you will be tried as an adult. Now, one of these people was 18, so he automatically will be tried as an adult. Another is 16. He will now be tried as an adult. The two others, one of them is 15 years of age. The other one is 16 as well. So three of the four will be tried as adults. The 15-year-old should be as well. So this idea that, oh, they're children, they just didn't know what they were doing because they're kids. You know, I understand that when you're talking about really doing stupid things. That we all have done. But when you are committing violent crimes, you don't blame that on the gun. Okay? You blame that on the person who chose to rob somebody with the threat of killing them if they didn't hand over whatever they wanted. So, here again, a four-person crime wave that was enabled and encouraged, to put it bluntly, enabled and encouraged by our juvenile justice system. So because these kids weren't told no beforehand, now they're all going to go away for a long time. And that will be justice. It's unfortunate, but it's justice. Oh, boy. You know, here it is the day after Columbus Day. Now the political left is really going to hate Christopher Columbus. You guys ready for this?
Hit me.
DNA experts have concluded after a long-awaited investigation that Christopher Columbus was not Italian and was not Spanish.
Wow.
He was Jewish.
Huh?
Really?
And apparently covered it up.
Wow.
Examinations of the bones of Christopher Columbus and his son Hernando showed a Jewish origin, something that he concealed during a time in which Jews were being persecuted in Spain, which sponsored his voyages. Mm-hmm. And other parts of Europe.
Wow.
This is not going down well in Genoa, Italy. They have always claimed him as a favorite son. But this is the culmination of 20 years of investigation led by professors at the University of Grenada.
Can't beat DNA, John.
Wow. There you go. How about that? Hey, let's talk again tomorrow. The Commute with Carlson.